Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Mickey Mantle was a good enough ball player so that Casey Stengel, his longtime manager with the Yankees, said of him, "This kid ain't logical. It's very confusing." Mickey Mantle was also a falling down drunk. In The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood, author Jane Levy describes the arc of Mantle's life and draws from it various ambitious conclusions. The book is arranged around several accounts of a particular meeting Jane Levy had with Mickey Mantle, a meeting during which the former ballplayer passed out in Ms. Levy's lap. When we spoke recently, I asked her to discuss that encounter.
Well, you have to add the salient words, "face down" in my lap, to get the full view of it.
I thought I'd let you do that.
Well, you know, as many tragic elements as there are to this story, that was a surreal and, in retrospect anyway, funny moment, because after all, here I found myself stuck beneath 200 pounds of grade A American hero, passed out, dead drunk, face down in my lap. I could hear the bells and whistles of the casino. It was the Claridge Hotel and Casino by that point, where he had signed on as a greeter. And the room was swirling the way the lemons would downstairs. And all I could think of is, how did Mickey Mantle end up face down in my lap? And that was the story, basically, that I set out to tell. Because when I went to Atlantic City in 83 as a reporter for the Washington Post, I couldn't write what really happened. It would have been a firing offense in 1983 to write this story. Today, Bill, it would be a firing offense not to write it.
You posit that much of what was self-destructive about Mickey Mantle can be traced to his childhood. How so?
Well, he grew up in an area called the Tri-State Mining District, and an industry that continued to thrive only up until the Depression, which is when Mutt Mantle brought his family to Commerce, Oklahoma. It's a barren, horrid landscape, one where fatalism percolates up from the earth. It is literally undermined. And you have this very coate sense of there being nothing stable in life. And in fact, people there are quite accustomed to the world collapsing beneath their feet because so much had been taken out of the ground. So Mickey came by that sense of fatality, honestly. And on top of that, there was alcoholism embedded in his DNA from his mother's side of the family, one of his aunts. There was also sexual abuse that he suffered, first at the hands of his half-older sister. And that's something that Merlin Mantle, Mickey's wife, first discussed in a family memoir published a year after Mickey died in 1996. And he was not only abused by his half-older sister, but he had the experience that I presume lots of boys have, of being chased down and fondled by neighborhood boys. He told his companion, Greer Johnson, that he also had a sexual relationship with a high school English teacher. He said to her, "That's the only way I got through high school, was by screwing the teachers." So, you know, every boundary was crossed. And it became palpable to me that it could well explain why he crossed so many boundaries of taste and decorum. And it certainly explained to Merlin his promiscuity, his taste in women, she said, his language and his treatment of women. And it also explained to her how one can be the center of attention, the center of New York, when New York was the center of the world in baseball and everything else, and still feel acutely isolated and alone.
Many of the stories that demonstrate how great a ballplayer Mickey Mantle was emphasize his power at the plate. Have you a favorite among his home run stories?
Well, I for sure the chapter about the tape measure home run, that has to be my favorite because, of course, it's integral to the creation of the myth of the Mick. And what happened was that Chuck Stobbs, a lefty for the Senators, threw him a ball. He wailed into it, and he hit it over the 32 rows of concrete bleachers in left field at Griffith Stadium. And that ball's had gone out of the ballpark before, off Ruth's bat and Dobie's, but only to right and right center field, not as far. Left field at Griffith Stadium was as capacious as Death Valley was at Yankee Stadium. Well, the ball kicked off the edge of a scoreboard and disappeared into the neighborhood, an area called LaDroite Park. And Red Patterson, according to legend, perpetuated largely by himself, stood up and said, "That one's got to be measured," and charged off after the ball. Well, in fact, Joe Trimble, a beat writer for the Daily News, New York Daily News, was the one who suggested, and mostly in jest, you know, you ought to go far, see how far that went. Now, most of the guys in the press box had some clue of how far it went. All they had to do was add up the distance from home plate to the base of the wall and the base of the wall to the back wall of the stadium. So all Red Patterson really had to do, as he later confessed, was pace off the distance from the back wall to where the ball allegedly landed. And when he returned with a tattered baseball, he also came back with a tale. And what he said was that he met a young boy named Donald Dunaway, who had found the ball and who took him to the spot at 434 Oakdale Place, a small street that ran perpendicular to the left field wall. And he gave him the ball in exchange for, depending on which paper you read the next morning, 75 cents, a dollar, $5, $10. And Red returned with this and the miraculous number 565. Well, it took me 3 years, Bill, but I found Donald Dunaway. I had to hire two private eyes to find him, including a guy who's an FBI profiler who found Kanzai in Pakistan after 5 years. And he told me this guy's harder to find than Kanzai. He lived 2 miles from where the stadium used to stand. Now on the site stands Howard University Hospital. And he told me the story from his point of view. He did not take anyone out there. He was taken by the usher, the ticket taker, at the left field stands where he went into the bleachers to the Yankee clubhouse, where he, in fact, exchanged the ball for a promise of a mantle ball, which he said never arrived. And I know this strains credulity, and I asked him 100 times. He swears $100. He never took anybody anywhere. He said, "I never gave them the address 434 Oakdale Place. I just said it landed behind one of those houses on Fifth Street."
Yogi Berra's wife, Carmen, told you that even at the top of his game, Mickey Mantle was a danger to himself and, quote, "he loathed himself." Does that strike you as overstatement?
No, no, it really doesn't. Sadly, I wish it were overstatement. I think that he was powerless to stop himself from his most self-destructive tendencies. I don't think that there was the help or the climate of candor available. It was a liquid time in America. Everybody had won for the road, if not four. I've wondered, Bill, recently, if there had been smartphones at the Copacabana and people had documented and posted on YouTube within seconds the shenanigans that went down in what was lovingly called the fracas at the Copa, would Mickey Mantle have been better off? If Mickey's recklessness, the kind of stuff that has in recent days and weeks and months caught up with Tiger Woods and Brett Favre and God knows how many athletes, if there had been a check and balance in technology, would he have been forced to come to grips with some of these things earlier? I think that's possible.
The standard evaluation of Mickey Mantle has always been, had he not torn up his knee at the very beginning of his career, or had he paid attention to rehabilitating himself instead of spending so much time in places like the Copacabana and other bars, he would have been even better. But you quote one of Mantle's teammates, Cleet Boyer, as saying, "How much better could he have been?" It's a great question, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's an impossible question to answer. You know, I had great trepidation about doing this book, Bill, because he was my hero and because what was I going to find that was new? So I was very ridiculously tenacious. That's why it took 5 years out of my life and 563 interviews. What I learned about that knee injury was that it was much more severe than they could diagnose at that time. He had what we call the unhappy trihead. He blew out his knee, ACL, MCL, torn cartilage, and he didn't have surgery until 2 years later. So he played on a completely compromised, unstable right knee. The cartilage ground and ground and ground on the surface of the joint so that even by playing, he was making it worse. And your thigh muscles have to compensate for the lack of stability. So, yeah, he should have rehabbed better. Yes, he took the weights that the doctors gave him to take on road trips and stuck them under the rug. Sure, he should have taken better care of himself in so many ways. But it wasn't all willful neglect that caused this. And the other thing that's true, and I really wanted to focus on the Willie, Mickey, and the Duke debate because it occupied so much of my childhood. Mm-hmm. My dad being a Willie guy who grew up on Coogan's Bluff and who tormented me with a daily box score. You know, when you take all the new stats, all those fancy morps and warps and vorps, and when you measure Mantle retroactively by some of those standards, OPS and on base plus slugging, he does extraordinarily well. Measures up unbelievably well, if not better than Willie Mays in many categories because of his ability to get walks, I think 100 plus 10 straight years. And, you know, his teammates, like Kleepoer, were able to see that.
Toward the end of his life, Mickey Mantle found sobriety, and one of the doctors who treated him during his rehab said that he had displayed a syndrome called, I'm quoting now, acquired situational narcissism. Is it fair to say that the high esteem in which he was held by his fans played a big part in Mantle's narcissism and ultimately his self-destruction?
I think it is, and I think it pertains to celebrities across the board. One of the sweetest, saddest stories was told to me by Steve Donahue, the Yankee trainer, who wanted very much to introduce his wife to Mickey and did so after Mickey got out of the Betty Ford Center in the winter of 1994. And he was showing off, you know, kind of bragging on how many people they knew in common and making chit-chat. And Mickey is standing there by the bar drinking a non-alcoholic beverage and says, "But Steve, I want to tell you something, Steve." Well, Steve's too busy wanting to show off to really listen to what the guy's saying. He says, "But Steve, I want to tell you something." Well, Steve's, you know, on his own, you know, wavelength. And finally, Mickey stops and says, "But Steve, I love you." Now, he had been taught, finally, to tell people how he felt and what they meant to him. But Steve was too busy, and he said this himself, wanting a piece of him to actually have a human interaction with him. And, you know, Phil Lynn said to me a great thing. He said he watched Mickey in the locker room at Yankee Stadium. Phil was, of course, a rookie infielder with the Yankees in 62. And he said he watched the way the other players talked to him, what he called the loneliness of greatness. You're so isolated because, again, all people want is to tell you about the time they saw you hit the ball off the right field facade. They don't ask, how are you? They don't really want to know, who are you? They know who they want you to be. And Phil said, you know, after watching that, he didn't want to be great.
Lots of athletes capture our imaginations, especially when we're young, and all athletes get old. What was it about Mickey Mantle that led you to conclude that he was, quote, the last boy, and that his end meant, and again I'm quoting, the end of America's childhood?
Well, he came along at the first year of the second half of the 20th century, a time that was still one of optimism. World War II was very recent. We had licked the Japs and the Germans. We were rebuilding Europe. And if you were good enough in America in 1949, when he first was signed by Tom Greenwade, you know, somebody was going to come along and find you, whether it was at a, you know, soda fountain counter or at a rinky-dink dive in New Jersey where, you know, Frank Sinatra was found singing, or at the Baxter Springs, Kansas ball field where Tom Greenwade stopped along the road. So I think he spoke to a time of optimism and a sense of ourselves, of a meritocracy. And I think that over the course of his public life, and his life was entirely public from the moment he stepped on the public stage in 1951, the rules about being public changed. Some for good, some for ill. I mean, 1950s America was the strong, silent 50s. It was the see no evil, hear no evil, and God knows write no evil in sports writing, 1950s. And he was accustomed, as were they all, to playing the game by the old rules, that they could do what they want, say what they want, you know, and that the reporters who traveled with him and whose tabs were often paid by the team, you know, were going to look the other way. Two great stories by Diane Shaw, a pioneering female sports writer, you know, they quoted him the way he actually talked. He was more perplexed than angry. How come they do that now? Well, she didn't say I was joking. And I said, well, she's trying to give a flavor of how you really are. You know how you really are. But she didn't say I was joking. You know, he just couldn't understand how much the world had changed around him.
Jane Levy is the author of The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood. The book is published by HarperCollins, and the author joined me from NPR in Washington. Jane, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, I will come back and talk to you anywhere, anytime.
My conversation with Jane Levy will be featured on this week's program. We'll also be examining FIFA's decision to play the 2022 World Cup in Qatar, and we'll have a story of an Australian football championship that extended the definition of overtime. ESPN's Tim Kirkjian will update the Hot Stove League action for us, and we'll visit with documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman on the occasion of the release of his most recent film, Boxing Jim. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.